Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Michael Kellett. He's executive director of the New England nonprofit organization Restore the North Woods, which he co-founded in 1992. He's been involved in national park, wilderness, public land, and endangered species issues for more than 30 years. In 1994, he developed the proposal for a 3.2 million acre Maine Woods National Park, which laid the groundwork for the 2016 designation by President Obama of Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument. In Massachusetts, he's worked to protect Walden Woods and Henry David Thoreau's birthplace and helped to develop legislation introduced in 2019, which would protect state conservation lands from logging and other development. So first off, thank you for your work on the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on.
We've talked before about the work for protecting areas in Maine. You had a great interview about that. And then also today I'd like to talk about attempts to protect parts of New Jersey. Can you talk about Restore's efforts to specifically work toward a national park in New Jersey? Can you talk about that, please?
Well, there is a proposal for a Delaware Water Gap National Park, which there is now a Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area, which straddles the border between New Jersey and Pennsylvania, along the Delaware River. And this area was created, actually it was supposed to be dammed and flooded. Fortunately, that never happened. And so the land ended up in public ownership. And the good thing is they turned it into a national park area. The downside is it's not big enough. It's about 50,000 acres, which for the Northeast is a good chunk of public land, but it's a long linear area, and it's more and more surrounded with development. So pretty soon this area is going to just become this long, narrow, isolated strip along the river. And so now's the time to think about connecting, expanding this area. And people need to know, people who don't live in the Northeast, they think of New Jersey and Pennsylvania probably as totally urbanized and developed, but actually there are still some pretty large tracts of undeveloped land. It was originally forest. It got cut and turned into farmland, but a lot of it is reverting to forest. And we've got this interim period where if we protect some of these lands, we can let the forest grow back and protect some large intact tracts. Otherwise, there's just going to be this endless sprawl, and we will have missed our chance. So here we have this 50,000-acre area, beautiful area. The Delaware River is the longest undammed river in the eastern United States. It seems pretty amazing. This river flows through, you know, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, yet the main stem river has no dams. So this is an amazing, important place. The other thing that's going on is that there are actually quite a bit of state-owned lands either directly adjoining or not too far away from this existing National Recreation Area. And these areas could be added to the National Recreation Area and connected with some acquired open space, private, you know, reverted farmlands or whatever that'll probably end up developed. They could be acquired by the public. So we could create from what we have now about 50,000 acre national recreation area to about a 275,000 acre national park, which is about the size of Rocky Mountain National Park. So you're talking about a pretty good size area. This is talking about mostly public land, some connecting private lands that could be acquired that would be probably lands that are going to end up being developed in the next decade anyway. So right now they may be cornfields, they may be reverting to forest. This area is really important because, number one, this river, of course, is really important for its aquatic habitats. Because it doesn't have any dams, there are fish such as the short-nosed sturgeon, which is an endangered species, alewife, blueback herring, American eels, lamprey, shad. These are all species that need free undammed rivers and they come up from the ocean, this is vital for those fish. There are mussels. This is one of the most important habitats for mussels, freshwater mussels, which are in trouble almost everywhere. You've got large areas of forest that could be, if they were allowed to grow back, you could have some big chunks of old growth, oak, hickory, maple, you know, very important habitats. Right now, the National Recreation Area is, most people don't know about it unless you live in the region, because most people have not heard of national recreation areas. If it were a national park, this would increase the visibility and funding and public support. That recently happened with New River Gorge in West Virginia, which was a national river, which is kind of a similar area. It's now a national park and preserve. That's what probably makes the most sense with Delaware Water Gap, because there's hunting right now, and people, that's a traditional thing. People are not going to want to give up hunting over this whole area, but you could designate part of it as a national park, which everybody knows, and then a part of it as a national preserve, which nobody knows what those are, but they're basically a national park with some additional things allowed. And that's how you could, you could also do that with these additional lands. There are a bunch of these state lands. Almost all the state lands are open to logging, artificial habitat manipulation for game species. Some of them are open to ORV, motorized off-road use. They are not well protected. So if they became a part of the national park, they would get national park system protection. So that's another important part here, is these state lands are not well protected. The other important thing is this area is within a pretty easy drive of about 50, 60 million people in New York City, Philadelphia, Wilmington, Delaware. This is really a densely populated part of the world. And so, Newark, New Jersey, this would be the only full national park within ready reach of these tens of millions of people in these large urban areas. So for all those reasons, it makes lots of sense to, we think to upgrade this area to a national park and preserve and add a bunch of these state lands. So they're already public lands. They would just have to be transferred from the state to the federal government. Now, there's opposition to the idea from hunting interests, which unfortunately, I have no problem with hunting per se, but you've got these hunting groups which basically every acre has to be open to hunting or they're unhappy. And to me, this ought to be a reasonable compromise where everybody gets something out of this. There's plenty of hunting land available for the number of hunters, but a national park would bring more visibility, more budget money to manage. It would bring more tourism to a lot of these little towns, which are, many of them are not doing that great in terms of their economy. It would bring more people. So anyway, that's one of 100 proposals for new national parks that Restore the North Woods is working on, but it's a very important one. There is a discussion by some local activists just changing the name of Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area to National Park or National Park and Preserve, which would be a good thing for all the reasons I mentioned in terms of what national parks do. But this is really an opportunity to go way beyond that, to protect a much bigger area. And with climate change and so forth, it's even more important to connect various pieces of habitat, because we know that wildlife are going to be migrating, habitats are going to shift, small tracts of isolated tracts of forest and natural habitats are going to be surrounded by development, and they're going to be drier, they're going to be more prone to disease and insects and perhaps fire. for all those reasons, for climate, for wildlife and biodiversity, and for people, this is a really good idea.
Thank you for all that. And I have a ton of questions. And I wanted to go back early on about some things, except you said the thing about hunting, and that made me ask, actually, that made me think of another question I want to go to before we do some more background work. So let's pretend that you were able to protect the 275,000 acres. And I have a friend who teaches at State University of New York, Binghamton, who they have a small college forest there, basically. And one of the problems with the forest is that there isn't hunting allowed. And because of the lack of predators, it ends up there's too many deer. And my friend is absolutely devoted to ground-dwelling birds and to amphibians. And the deer are hammering the undergrowth. And so they're hammering the ground-dwelling birds. And so my question is, if you were able to protect 275,000 acres, and I'm coming at this from a purely biocentric perspective, what predators, would that be enough? Would that be large enough to allow predators to do their job? Do you see what I'm asking?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Well, two parts to that question. The first part is regarding deer and hunting. There's actually plenty of evidence that hunting, sports hunting, doesn't really have much of an impact on deer populations. That's it, unless you have basically sharpshooters who go out and are killing as many deer as possible to reduce the population. Unless you do that, and there's not much public support for that sort of thing, it doesn't really have much of an impact on deer populations, because deer, as you probably know, if they're under pressure, they ramp up their reproduction. So the problem is not a lack of hunting. That's not the problem.
Well, there's one
plenty of hunters. That's not the problem. The problem is too much habitat for deer.
Yep.
And too few, as you mentioned, too few predators. So in terms of habitat, if you expand, right now they're doing this logging all over the place on these public lands. That's creating perfect habitat for deer, because deer like open edge habitats, which is what you get when you clear cut and log. So if you got rid of logging on 200,000 additional acres over what we have now, that is going to reduce deer habitat. So there'll be fewer deer on those lands. That's well documented that that's the case. So that's going to help to reduce deer right there. The other thing is, in terms of predators, when you're talking about 275,000 acres, now this would not be one big solid chunk like Rocky Mountain National Park. Unfortunately, you're talking about multiple pieces of land, some of which are, you know, as big as like 15, 20,000 acres in a fairly good chunk. So they're not tiny, but still, you've got these pieces, and then in between, you're going to have roads and towns and so forth. It's pretty rural, but still, you got people living there. So number one, there would be plenty of space for cougars and wolves and so forth to live there, but humans would have to tolerate them, because they would, no question, they would run into people in that kind, with that many people in that area. So That's a cultural, social problem, and it can be changed. I really think a lot of people are open-minded about predators. They just don't really know. They haven't been given choices. They haven't been involved in any kind of constructive decision. There's not really, this is not like the West, where you got ranchers and cattle, and they blame cows that die, you know, calves or whatever, on wolves, which is usually bogus. But that's really not the issue here. It's really just humans not being used to having predators and feeling threatened. And so that can change with education. A good example is, you know, in Europe, you're probably aware, parts of Europe, like in Spain and Romania and other places, I think part of France and the mountains of Italy, there are wolves. There are wolves living there. And there are plenty of people. It's like this area. There, you know, it's not super urbanized in the areas where the wolves are, but there are lots of people. There are farms, there are towns, but people basically recognize that the predators serve a valuable purpose, that they deserve to survive, and they try their best to put up with the predators. And it's not perfect, but these, you have wolves that you have, you know, a viable population. They live, they keep down help to prevent overpopulation of some of the predated the prey species. So it can happen. One of the things that the National Park Service is really good at is educating the public about wildlife and so forth. And even though there are major problems in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem with killing bison and killing wolves and probably killing grizzlies if the anti-predator people have their way, it's in spite of the National Park Service, it's because you got all the state, you got these three state governments and you got state agencies and you got the hunting interests and you got ranching interests and whatever, all against protecting predators. I don't think you have that kind of organized predator hating coalition in the Northeast. There certainly are interests that are like that, but I think there are a lot of people in the Northeast that would welcome some way to bring back predators. Nobody's trying right now. There's no organized effort. Unless we have large tracts of public protected land, there's not any safe place to bring these predators back to get them started again. And that's one of the advantages of our Maine Woods National Park. That's why we need a White Mountain National Park and a Green Mountain National Park, Quabbin National Park. These are all core areas where predators could survive and thrive, and eventually they could start repopulating the region.
So thank you for saying that, all of that, and your defense of predators, and for also reminding all of us about the importance of habitat for, like, deer overpopulation. That, it drives me batty when people ignore logging, the effects of logging and edges on deer. And so thank you so much for reminding us that as these forests mature and as the edges disappear, that will by itself improve the interior habitat.
Right.
So another question about this before we move on, which is, and sorry for the ignorance here, but where would say this park were to come about, are there already mountain lions there, or would mountain lions have to repopulate?
I don't think anyone knows that whether there are any mountain lions or not, but as far as the official judgment is, there aren't any. So there may be a few roaming from the north, or, you know, they've even documented that there may be some individuals have made it from, like, South Dakota to the Great Lakes and even further. But there's no known self-sustaining population right now of cougars. So
in the entire Northeast?
In the entire Northeast.
Wow.
Yep. In fact, all the way down, basically down to Florida. So the entire eastern part of the country, other than Florida, there's no official mountain lion population. I think there are a few people report them in Vermont and New Hampshire especially. There probably are a few individuals that come from other places, but they end up being killed, or they're isolated, they can't find a mate, and so forth. So it's not viable the way it is right now. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, has been, they're totally gutless on this. They refuse to do the right thing. And so they basically have said, oh, well, they're extinct, so we don't have to do anything to bring them back. And the same with the eastern wolf. They're on the verge of basically saying the same thing. They're controversy averse. They don't want to stand up to these ignorant haters of predators, which are, I think, a small minority. They're just loud and obnoxious.
Yeah, you know, I've been out in the wild a lot in my life, and I've seen, in my life, seen wolves, bobcats, see bears constantly. I have never in my life seen a mountain lion in the wild, and I would love to.
Yeah, well, and again, that's why we don't know for sure that there are none, and there probably are a few, because they are so secretive, but it's unlikely there's a self-sustaining, relatively large population anywhere in the East other than Florida. And as we know, they're barely holding on. And it's because people, they get hit by cars, they get, you know, we're developing open space. But Florida, the reason I think that they're surviving in Florida, even though there's a lot of anti-predator mentality, is because you've got these large areas. You've got Everglades National Park, Big Cypress National Preserve. There's some large state parks and wildlife refuges, and they have a place they can go to get away. That's what we need more in the East.
Well, absolutely.
In the Northeast. Well, the East, everywhere north of the Everglades is where we need a lot more of that.
Well, as I think you and I would both agree that pretty much the primary answer to everything is habitat, habitat, and habitat.
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit more. I have another sort of random question here, which is, just yesterday I was interviewing somebody about how some offshore wind is going to harm right whales, etc., and they mentioned that they're also going to harm sturgeon. And I'm sorry to be such a dope, but you know, I'm pretty much, the sturgeon that I'm aware of are primarily inland, and I didn't know that sturgeon go to the ocean. Can you talk to me about that for just a moment?
Oh yeah, well, the Atlantic sturgeon are I don't know if they officially are considered anadromous, but they do travel up the rivers to spawn and so forth, and that's why they're in danger in the short-nosed sturgeon. There's a sturgeon that travels to the Gulf of Mexico, and there are inland populations of sturgeon, but a lot of the key populations do travel from the ocean up river.
Okay, so let's go back. Now, finally, I want to go back and ask one of the basic questions. You mentioned this, but I suspect that what you said is absolutely true, that when a lot of people think of New Jersey, they think of Camden, or they think of New York City just across the river. They think of just huge cities. But honestly, yeah. When I've been to New Jersey a few times, and much of the state is absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
And wild, frankly, or at least a little bit wild. And one of the things I love about your work is that there's a word you use that I keep forgetting what it is, which is that you don't manipulate habitat to help old growth slowly return. You allow the forest to do what the forest wants to do. And what is your word for that? It's not reforestation.
Proforestation?
Proforestation. Thank you. I have a block on that. I love that word. Can you, A, discuss proforestation a tiny bit, and then, B, talk about the importance of allowing damaged lands to come back on their own?
Well, it's interesting. The fact that someone had to make up the word proforestation, we had the term, of course, reforestation. We have the term afforestation, which most people don't know about, but that's planting trees where there weren't any trees or there haven't been trees for a long time. But it shows how human-oriented our thinking is about everything. So we think of forests as, well, of course, we either cut them down and we're going to reforest after we cut them down, and that implies actively doing something, reforesting. A lot of times it's planting. Or afforestation, which is we're going to go to an area that maybe hasn't had trees for a long time for whatever reason. And we're going to plant trees there. And that's afforestation. But, gee, if you just leave it alone, it grows back on its own in most places. Most places in the world, certainly in the United States, if you just leave an area that's been cut alone, it tends to grow back just fine over a period of time. And so, but there was no word for it. It's bizarre. So some people I've worked with who they wrote a paper and they had to invent a term, proforestation, which, and they thought about what kind of, you know, what should we talk about? Well, it's basically actively allowing the forest to come back. And, but without doing anything, you just make the decision to let it happen. And my feeling is there are loads of areas in the United States, if not all over the place, but we basically have been propagandized to believe that, well, the old growth forest is gone. It's been cut over. A lot of it was farmland. So that's gone. So it's, you know, it's all a managed landscape. It's all a working landscape. So forget about it. Get over it. There's nothing to see here. We just got to manage this forever. And in fact, it's better when it's managed because we know what we're doing and we're going to make it healthier and better and bigger and stronger, which is totally bogus, based on nothing. It's based on like Gifford Pinchot kind of pseudo science. And the reality is there's more and more, in fact, a new wave of science that's showing that just leaving forests alone, the forests grow back faster, they come back healthier, they end up recovering better and faster. What a big surprise. So especially in the Northeast, there's no place where you need to be actively messing around with the forest to make it recover. You just leave it alone and it's going to come back. That's it. And you hear all kinds of excuses from foresters because they love to manipulate things. It's just like I analogize this to dam builders. Dam builders, they see a free-flowing river and they go, oh my God, all that wasted water, it's going to the ocean, unused, unutilized, what a waste. We got to put a dam there. Foresters go, oh my God, there's a forest, look at those trees, they're getting old, some of them are going to fall down, what, they're not going to be put to any useful purpose, and they're going to get disease. And so we better cut them down to save them from dying and falling down. It's the same mentality. So basically, we need to just get used to the idea of drawing lines around areas, buy, hopefully as much as possible, buying them or acquiring them for public ownership, because that's the longest, most permanent protection. And then just stepping back, getting rid of roads, getting rid of artificial developments, but otherwise basically just letting them come back on their own. And in a couple hundred years, they're going to be look just fine. They're going to do great. This whole thing about climate change, oh my God, the climate change is shifting all the trees. So we got to go all over the place and plant trees from South Carolina and Maine and blah, blah, blah. This is just total cockamamie pseudoscience. This is based on nothing. These are just people who just can't stand not to be doing something when there's a problem. You know, they can't do anything about hurricanes yet. If they thought they could, I'm sure they'd be out there trying to solve the hurricane problem. So all of this management stuff is just totally this antiquated, obsolete, scientifically unsupported. It's just a human, it's hubris of people who can't keep their hands off nature and for some reason think they know better, but history has shown they always don't know better. We've always screwed up nature. Every time we mess around with it, we make it worse.
So there's a line that I got from David Ehrenfeld, but I recently learned that he was quoting somebody else, but I can't remember who, which is, nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
You know, I moved into the land where I live. I've lived here 22 years, and when it was cut over in the 70s, I moved in 1999, and as soon as I moved in, there were some People said, you know, you ought to thin them out. You ought to do this. It'll make it, it. And I was like, no, it can thin itself out. And I mean, there was some dog hair from dog hair. That's what they call really, you know, skinny trees all put close together. Right. There was a bunch of dog hair here. And honestly, a lot of the dog hair has died on its own. And then they either fall over and get eaten by mushrooms, or they stand and get eaten by mushrooms. And it's just doing its thing. And it is creating the mosaic of different species that it wants. I mean, that's the presumption is, you know, does a forest know better how to be a forest, or do I know better how to be a forest? And the truth is that it knows better. It evolved over millions of years.
Right. And really, when you dig down deeper, I'm working on a paper to debunk this whole thing about needing to create more early successional forests, because supposedly we don't have enough and all these species are declining and we're losing all these birds because we don't have enough open habitat and blah, blah, blah. And of course, the solution to all of this is logging and other intensive burning, all this stuff. But the reality is, if you think about it, what it is you've got these people and they're just reconstructing what was familiar and comforting in their lived experience. So what they're doing, you know, in 1600, for example, New England was almost completely covered with dense old growth or forest that had either, some had blown over, but it was growing back. It was all forested almost completely. It did just fine on its own. There were natural openings from, you know, freezes and tornadoes and ice storms or whatever, but most of the landscape was pretty much solid old growth. And as you mentioned, species that lived here had evolved with that forest for eons, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So, but then, you know, colonists come over in the 1600s, they mowed the entire forest down by the mid 1800s. So by the mid 1900s, the forest was growing back and much, you know, there were all these areas that were like 50 year old trees. But a lot of it was old farms that had been abandoned maybe during the Depression. So they were only maybe 10, 20 years old. So there was all this scrubby stuff. And you had all these species that like that kind of habitat. And actually, they weren't even probably, a lot of them weren't even around in 1600. They moved in when they had the opportunity, when all the forests got mowed down. Well, these guys got used to these species. They like them. And a number of them are huntable, like woodcock and grouse. So they like, deer, white-tailed deer. There are more white-tailed deer now in the Northeast than there ever were before Europeans came. But they like that. This is what they like. This is their favorite. These are their favorite species. They get used to these birds. They get used to these animals to hunt. They get used to the look of these open areas, and they like it. So it's like an open zoo. It's like they're recreating an open zoo for their preferences. And then they backfill this science to validate their decision to do this, but it's really based in just totally anthropocentric preferences. And that's what this is all about. And then, of course, there's an unholy alliance with the forest products industry, which, of course, any excuse to cut down trees is great. And then you got the hunting industry, which, of course, they love to have more woodcock, more deer, more grouse, even though they're unnaturally overpopulated. So what? The more, the better. You can shoot more of them. And that's what we got right now. So all this opposition to allow, and this mentality has taken over all of the state wildlife agencies, the U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, all the state fish and wildlife agencies, many of the conservation organizations, they all buy into this. And it's because they're anthropocentric in their thinking. So this seems normal.
So I completely agree with you. And I'm going to pretend for one moment to disagree, but don't worry, I'm going to come back around, which is, I actually think that there should be more early successional forests, but I think they should be made from cornfields, and then they should be allowed to become late successional forests. So the thing is, you don't turn a late successional forest into an early successional forest. What you do is you allow a vacant lot to become early successional forest and then later late successional forest. So if you want your habitat for the early successional forest creatures, they can go to, they can do this in 20 years in a cornfield. Do you see what I'm getting at? It's crazy to take late successional forests and turn them into early successional when you have lots of land that is even more degraded than early successional. Allow it to come back a little bit and then come back more after that.
Exactly. And the other part of that point is that most of the, when you hear about all the birds declining and so forth, most of the birds that are in decline are either shorebirds, birds that need, you know, coastal areas like beaches that where they get run over by ORVs or the beach has been developed, or grassland and prairie species. And grassland and prairie species, the problem is not in New England in the Northeast. The problem is in Ohio and Indiana and Iowa and South and North Dakota and whatever. And that's because all of their former natural prairie habitat has been turned into cornfields for ethanol. There was a study done not long ago where they documented that something like 2.5 million acres of native prairie has been plowed under and turned into cornfields because of subsidies for ethanol, for which is a bad solution to energy problems. So that's where the problem is in terms of early successional birds. And what you're talking about, what it means is that areas where they've made the mistake and wiped out the entire prairie, yes, those are places where we probably do need active, at least getting the first step going. There may be places where there need to be reseeding of prairie areas or whatever because they've wiped out so much that there's not even any seed source left. But that's really unusual. There are no forest areas like that.
And just for the record, a really good book on how quickly prairies can recover if you allow them to is Grassland by Dick Manning, Richard Manning. Mm-hmm. Great book. Anyway, let's go back to the national park stuff. So
yeah.
A couple questions. For people who don't know, what is the, when you talk about national park, just can you give an overview of the level of protection that national parks afford as compared to national forests, a recreation area, a state park? Because I don't know that necessarily a lot of people know the distinctions.
Right, they probably don't. Well, most people's familiarity with national parks would be places like Old Faithful or Yosemite Valley or the South Rim of the Grand Canyon or Trail Ridge Road or Great Smoky Mountains National Park sitting in traffic. And so most people think of national parks as being sort of these developed, crowded places, beautiful, but really kind of overdone and overdeveloped and so forth. So they don't really think of them as wild places. In reality, I've done some calculation and research, and about 85 to 90% of the national park system's land base is unroaded, undeveloped backcountry. And about 50% of the national park lands are designated wilderness, which is way more than the percentage for national forests or Bureau of Land Management or National Wildlife Refuge lands. So national parks have about 50% of the total wilderness in the of federal public lands. So if you want wilderness, national parks are the place to go. But even outside of wilderness, most national parks are undeveloped, have no roads. There have not been any major visitor infrastructure built in any national park created since the 1970s. That's an old sort of the classic concept of, you know, getting more cars and whatever. On the other hand, so national parks have a unique legal basis. The congressional legislation that created them requires national parks to conserve the wildlife and the historic areas and the recreation and allow public access and enjoyment. However, it also requires that the parks be kept unimpaired for future generations. None of the other types of public lands have that sort of mandate. They don't have to be unimpaired. They can do whatever they want. They can, in fact, as we know, the U.S. Forest Service and BLM and a lot of the National Wildlife Refuge areas have been seriously impaired for future generations for various reasons. So national park wilderness areas are the most protected public lands because national park wilderness areas don't allow even hunting or grazing, which are allowed in National Forest and Bureau of Land Management and a lot of National Wildlife Refuge wilderness areas. And so that was an exception in the Wilderness Act. So if you go to a Bureau of Land Management wilderness area, it might be this big, beautiful place. And you'll go and you'll find cows roaming around. You'll find cow watering holes. You'll find fences to guide the cows. They can even use ORVs to help service the cattle's watering areas and whatever. I was in Great Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which is a Bureau of Land Management monument, which is a beautiful, incredible area. But there are cattle and cattle enclosures there where you go and there's cow dung and there's mud and so forth. You don't have that in national parks. There are a couple of national parks where they made exceptions, a couple of national recreation areas. And I think Dinosaur National Monument, they've got some grazing, but the major national parks, the ones that people can name, they don't have any cattle, they don't have any, and they also don't have hunting, which, again, I'm not anti-hunting, but almost the entire U.S. land base is open to hunting or development or resource extraction. There's virtually no place other than national parks that are off limits to hunting. And just from an ecological standpoint, that makes no sense. We know that hunting affects wildlife. And we know that in Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem, for example, Yellowstone National Park, 2.2 million acres doesn't allow hunting. But as soon as wolves walk out of the national park, even to a national forest wilderness area like the Absaroka Wilderness, they can get blown away by hunters. Same with in bison. As soon as bison want to leave the national park, they get rounded up and killed or herded off to probably eventually be killed. Grizzly bears, that's only a matter of time before they probably will lose their endangered species status. As soon as they leave the park, they're going to get blown away. So the only places that are 100% protected for wildlife are national parks, and that don't allow cattle, which are direct competitors with wildlife, are national parks. So there are some, you know, there are some national wildlife refuges. Some national forest areas where you don't have that, but it's mainly because of the ecology, not because, you know, there are national forest areas where there aren't any trees much in Nevada, for example, so they don't do logging, but they allow cattle grazing. And the other thing, of course, is mining, oil and gas drilling and so forth. That doesn't happen in national parks. As most people probably know, that's happening all over the place on Bureau of Land Management lands, National Forest lands. The Green Mountain National Forest approved a big wind power development, which has these huge wind power turbines that were stuck in the middle of an area that actually should be part of a wilderness area. So national parks are, and especially national park wilderness, are the most protected federal lands. Most state lands are not even as protected as the worst protected federal lands. The state forest lands are horribly mismanaged almost everywhere. They don't even, you know, their standards, they just log their brains out. Many of them allow drilling and mining and, you know, every kind of development that they can make money from. State parks, some states, the state parks are well protected. But they, for the most part, you're not talking about a huge acreage. There are a few large state parks. You know, you've got Adirondack Park. The preserve in Adirondack Park in New York is well protected, although they allow hunting. Baxter State Park in Maine is a large area, which is mostly protected from hunting and logging. And then you got in California, you've got Anza Borrego Desert State Park, which is well protected. But most of the state parks are relatively small. So good for the states when they do provide good, you know, strong protection for them, but that's not really a large part of the land base.
So we're starting to run out of time. I've got a couple questions left. One of them is, so even though I'm biocentric and I care more about nature than anything else, if I were the governor of New Jersey and you wanted to make this national park and include state lands, I would want something back. How does that work when the feds acquire state lands? Do they just buy them outright, or do they have to trade, or what does the state get out of giving up its land to the feds?
Well, that's a good question. The answer is that a lot of states have willingly and eagerly given land to become state parks.
No, national parks. So
Great Smoky Mountain National Park was almost completely land that was acquired by North Carolina in Tennessee, and then donated to the federal government. Shenandoah National Park was acquired by the state of Commonwealth of Virginia. Big Bend National Park, the original lands for Big Bend, which was a good chunk of it, were ranch lands. They were acquired by the state of Texas. And you can, there are many, Mammoth Cave was like that. So the reality is that there's plenty of precedent for that. And the reason these states did it is because they did see an advantage. And the advantage they saw is, number one, this, by creating a national park, of course, you bring tourism, you bring visitors, you bring federal money to manage the land and to provide programs for recreation and education. Also, it creates a whole aura of protection and environmental quality for the state. So, for example, a recent example, even though it didn't involve state lands, New River Gorge in West Virginia. So here you got West Virginia, which is one of the reddest states. You would think they would hate the federal government. They wouldn't want any further protection by the federal government. They would want to probably get rid of any federal lands. But in fact, the Republican governor, one of the senators is Republican congresspeople. They were enthusiastic about upgrading this national river, which most people had never heard of, to a full national park. And it's because of the things I'm talking about. They've already had more visitors. The local communities are doing better business. You know, it has its downsides, but I don't think there are too many communities who would prefer no business to having too much business. And it creates a responsibility to manage that kind of, that pressure and development. But I've got another good example, and again, it's not state land, but here, Grand Canyon. You probably know the history of Grand Canyon is that it was proposed as a national park right around the turn of the century, very early 1900s. And that was federal land, but it's in Arizona, which is was very conservative, at least, and it still is in that region. And The proposal for a national park was bitterly opposed by local people, by the state state delegation, the governor, whatever. They hated it. They said, oh, no, it'd be much better for this area to be mined and grazed with cattle, and eventually we can put some dams in. That's the real future of the region. Well, of course, fast forward to today, you look at the license plate of Arizona. What does it have? It has a picture of the Grand Canyon, and it's called the Grand Canyon State. And it's because, you know, in the end, practicality overrides ideology. And with states, the reality is there are a lot of benefits that come with having a national park. And, you know, they vary in the amount of resources they have to help make that happen. But, for example, you know, with the Delaware Water Gap, these lands are already state lands. So the state wouldn't be having to buy new land. The state already has those lands. And in fact, the state has an expense to take care of those lands. They have to, they have to have law enforcement. They have to prevent ORVs from going off trails. They have to prevent the vandalism. It costs a lot of money. And in fact, that's one of the reasons they log state lands in a lot of cases, is they try to defray the cost of holding these lands. So all of a sudden, the federal government takes them over. They've done away with all their expenses. All the overhead for those lands are now taken by the American people, which I think is totally fair because it benefits all Americans. So anyway, there are lots of reasons for states to support national park areas, even if they have to give up lands to do it.
Great. So that makes perfect sense. Thank you so much for that. And we're really running out of time now, but can you talk about for just a moment about what could be done to make this happen?
Well, most people right now probably feel like politically, how could anything be worse? How are we going to do anything positive? It's so why even talk about initiatives like expanding the national park system? We're talking about tripling the size of the national park system. I think we could do it by 2030. If we really get serious, we're talking about 30% of the U.S. being protected by 2030. This would up the percentage to about 20% from what it is now, about 14%. The thing is that national parks are really popular. Even in the worst of times, right now, national parks are very popular. I just read an article about the hearings in Congress where Republican members of Congress who normally are not pro-environment at all are supporting increasing the budget for the National Park Service to help defray the cost of fixing roads and so forth. And they're saying things like, people love national parks. This is an easy one. And so what we need to do is rally the public, the American public, around doing a program of expanding the national park system. And we need to defer to local groups and activists in their own regions to lead the way. I can't create a Delaware Watergate National Park, but there are lots of great activists in New Jersey and Pennsylvania who could lead the way on that. And I think even a lot of conservative Republicans, they know that people love national parks. And the most extreme right-wing ones will never support it. But I think you could get enough of a public pressure to do this. It's not going to happen right away, but these things take time. And what you got to do is you got to start. And right now, there's no national initiative for any large-scale protection, period. There's nothing. There's nothing. It's there's talk about regulation. There's talk about improving management. That's all great. But I'm talking about literally having specific areas that could be designated as national parks. The public gets that. People know what national parks are. They love national parks. They support more national parks. So, but the missing piece is we need some leadership to say, here's what the possibilities are, here's where they are. Every state can have a national park, and we need your help. And the way to do it is we need to organize, and then we need federal legislation to do it.
So that would be a great place to end, but I actually have one more question. Sorry about that. Which is, it's two questions in one, which is, how far is it from New York City up to the Catskills, and how far is it from New York City to the Delaware water gap, the area you're talking about? Because I'm just thinking, you know, as well as mobilizing people, you know, getting the people of New York City to have another place they can go that is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the Catskills is absolutely famous for people from New York City going there for recreation.
Right.
And how far is that? Do you know? Do you know how, what the point is, what's the comparative distance? Would this be just as close almost?
Yes, it's about the same. It's about less than 100 miles, depending on where you are.
Well, that's nothing.
Yeah, it is basically nothing. It's very close. But people don't know about the Catskills, and the Catskills are the advantage there is a lot of it is already state land and it's preserved, so at least it's not being seriously threatened, although the Catskills would certainly qualify as a national park area, so would the Adirondacks. But they're not on our list of the top 100 because they're pretty well taken care of right now. Whereas Delaware Water Gap is itself, but these lands around it are not.
Oh,
so what we did is we tried to focus on areas that are that both high quality and important, but also are not going to stay that way unless we do something, and also where we could do something. So we're talking about areas that are already public land. But yes, one of the key things is to create more national parks near large metropolitan areas. That's one of the top priorities. Most people don't live near a national park. Here we are talking about trying to reduce the amount of plane flights, the amount of driving, the amount of use of fossil fuels. Yet most people, if you want to go to a national park, you've got to go a long way. You've got to travel. You've got to burn up a bunch of fossil fuels. What if you had a national park 100 miles away? You wouldn't burn up too much fuel to get. In fact, some of these you could have public transportation to get there.
That's great. That's great. Well, let's make it happen. So,
absolutely.
So thank you so much for your great work in the world. I love talking with you, and thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Michael Kellett. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.